From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. In 1971, when my guest, Galadriel Allman, was 2 years old, her father, Duane Allman, was killed in a motorcycle accident. At that time, Duane Allman was the leader of a rising rock group, the Allman Brothers Band, and a top session musician who played on a wide variety of artists' tracks. A lot of that music can be heard on the box set Sky Dog, which Galadriel Allman assembled last year. She has now published a well-written and well-researched biography of Duane Allman, Please Be With Me, a song from my father, Duane Allman. Galadriel Allman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
And in your book, you said, everybody who ever talks about my father starts by talking about his death, and then here I just went and did the exact same thing. Sorry.
Well, it's a big part of the story, you know, is the sadness of losing him so young. And when you look at it at the beginning, it's kind of remarkable how much music he was able to make in that short time. He was just shy of his 25th birthday, so the fact that he's so well remembered and has such a large body of work is pretty impressive.
Really? And he didn't start recording until, how old was he when he made his first recording?
You know, he had early bands that actually did go into the studio, but when he was probably around 19. But he didn't, you know, join the Allman Brothers Band until 1969. They only had 2.5 years together, and that's the music that he's best known for, of course. So, you know, it was a very brief career.
Well, and I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about you and this book. It's a really, and I want the listeners to know, it's just a wonderful book. It's a very well-written book, and it's got a lot of style to it. And so have you been a writer before?
You know, this is my first long project, and it's the first thing I've ever published. But I went to Sarah Lawrence College and studied writing there and studied literature, and it was always my aspiration to write. And, you know, I had this sense of being born into a really powerful story, and I wanted to wait until I was sort of strong enough to carry it, because it's so, I knew I would only get one chance to do it, and I felt like I had to be ready to become a public person. So I actually waited to craft it until I could really kind of dedicate myself to it and was old enough and mature enough to handle it.
Was the writing of the book and the assembling of the Sky Dog box set of Duane Allman's work, was that something you were doing simultaneously, or did one lead to the other?
I was doing it simultaneously. It took about 2 years all in to do the box set, although it was a project that Bill Levinson, who was the co-producer with me and who's really the one who did most of the organizational stuff and really did the heavy lifting. I sort of had my opinions about it and helped gather the songs and wrote the liner notes, but Bill was really the one who had the expertise. He's worked on so many great sets, and he really pulled me in the last couple of years to have, you know, a more personal take on the material. And it was such a gift to me to do those two things simultaneously, because I could sort of go through our tapes and hear the exact songs that were being played at the moments of the stories I was hearing. So it's kind of became a great counterpoint. But both projects had sort of separate and very long lives, you know.
Is this what kind of music do you listen to? I mean, are you a fan of, as they called it for a while, Southern rock? I mean, is that your thing, or what do you like to hear?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the term Southern rock that's really kind of stuck with the brothers is, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer. I think they were actually so inspired by the blues and jazz and a pretty broad range of music that's really, I kind of go back to their root as much as I go back to music that they kind of spawned. You know, I think of the later rock bands that were really influenced by them to be more truly Southern rock, but I listen to a huge selection of music. I love, you know, sort of more classic rock like Jimi Hendrix. I love, you know, Miles Davis and John Coltrane. I love listening to Delaney and Bonnie and other musicians that my father played with. And there's some current things I listen to, too. I listen to Wilco and Cat Power. But I think, you know, growing up in this band, you really do have this sense of drawing from influences from a broad base of music, because they were so eclectic and they were really putting their own spin on genres that they were listening to. So I think it made all of us open-minded, you know, all the kids of the music.
Well, I like how you paint a picture of the origins of the Allman Brothers Band, that, you know, what Duane was looking for with two drummers and two guitarists was putting together a kind of rock band that emulated what Miles Davis and John Coltrane were doing. They could take a little Donovan song and jam on it for four sides.
You know, one of my big aspirations with the book was to sort of get a closer sense of what my dad was compelled by and why he picked up a guitar and what he was interested in building, because they did do something so unique and so lasting that I really wanted to know sort of what his influences were and also sort of what his vision was. And I feel like I really did get closer to that than I ever thought I would, just by talking to studio musicians he'd worked with and other artists he'd worked with, and really got a sense that he was processing all of his experiences. You know, he had been in cover bands as a teenager, playing all kinds of R&B and kind of pop and the, you know, Beatles songs and Bird songs, all different kinds of, you know, radio hits that kids would come and dance to. And then he went on to try to do original material with his brother in a band called the Hourglass, which was sort of emulating more of a San Francisco psychedelic sound, which wasn't really a good fit for them, but they really did kind of explore that terrain. And, you know, they also really tapped into the blues because it was really the root of where they were from. You know, they were growing up in the South and they were exposed to that kind of music. And you can just hear and see how step by step in his career he really did draw on these strengths and learn different techniques and different sounds that it all came into play in the Allman Brothers Band. You know, it sort of was put into the service of these songs that are almost hard to define. They're so interesting. You know, they are kind of epic and they're really based on improvising, but they've got a strong kind of American rock and blues root.
And so you discovered that both you and your father, I guess you always knew this, but I mean, it's kind of interesting that both you and your father lost your fathers when you were young.
Yes, and you know, I really hadn't put that together. It sounds so strange, but somehow I didn't really realize that we were almost exactly the same age, and I never really thought about it in terms of how it must have impacted him emotionally and how it changed his life to be raised by a single mother and to be fatherless, which I, you know, was so intimately aware of what that feels like. There is this sense of not knowing part of your story, which I think really was part of what drove him to find music, you know, is that kind of soul searching. So I did. I came to really identify with his story as well.
And I want to ask this question as delicately as I can. I mean, I understand that anybody would have a romantic view of their father, especially if their father was a great, well-remembered rock star. But your father had actually left your mother at the time of his death, and he not only left her, but, you know, he forced her to leave her friends and the community of the Allman Brothers Band that was such a part of your and your mother's life. Now, I imagine that would left her with some pretty hard feelings. Now, how did she feel about you writing this book? And have you had to struggle with your feelings about what your father did?
Well, sure. I mean, I think it's a complicated picture, you know, in my family, as I think it is in many families, especially because they were so very young. I mean, my mother was 18 when she got pregnant, and my father was in his early 20s. So there's this sense that if I keep it in perspective, if I think about my own life when I was in my late teens and early 20s and how kind of ephemeral some of those relationships were and that love was, I think it makes more sense to me. But there were certainly, you know, deep wounds that my mother had, because she did have all of the kind of idealistic hopes of having her family succeed, of course. And it was hard to see that. But when you understand the kind of life he was leading and you really see the, you know, incredible time commitment to the Allman Brothers Band and the number of, you know, day after day after day on the road, I could really kind of have compassion for him, what he was trying to build, both at home and away, you know, purposes. It was kind of an impossible job, both. I think that in some ways it's often the case that children and families in general get the short end of the stick with artists. I think it's kind of a common story. And also that women, you know, really do support men going out and exploring their creativity and get kind of left behind raising kids, which I think is often a calling and is often a beautiful thing. But sometimes it's also, you know, a real sacrifice that gets made, and especially at that time. I think it was a different time in the late 60s. So it was an interesting story for me on the level of, you know, what I draw from both of my parents' stories, because they're fairly different. They had really different experiences, and I wanted to show both sides of that family story.
We're talking to Galadriel Allman, and she is the daughter of Duane Allman, and she just wrote a great book about him called Please Be With Me. And I guess it must have been difficult for you when you were in school and they would say, and call roll, and they'd say Galadriel, and everybody would say, which Galadriel? Because there's so many, and there's like five.
Yeah, right. Right, no. Actually, it's funny. When I was about seven, I guess I was in first or second grade, my school teacher made my entire class learn how to spell my name, which was like a whole spelling class. It was really embarrassing. But yeah, it's an unusual name. And my father was a big reader and loved adventure books and fantasies, and he came to really particularly love the trilogy by J.R.R. Tolkien, and that's where my name is from. She was the princess of the elves.
Yes, Kate Blanchett plays you in the movie.
That's right.
But so what about your mother? How has she reacted to your book? What does she think of your book?
You know, she's been really supportive of me. She's been really... she's very proud. She's very excited to watch me finally getting to do what I've always wanted to do, because I've always wanted to write. And I also think it's been a long road. She's watched me do this for about 5 years. So I think she's gotten comfortable with all of the stories and knew what I was going to put out there. But it's also, I think it's an adjustment as well to sort of, accept that I'm becoming more of a public person, that her story is out there. You know, it's certainly not all easy, but she's also willing, and and we're both so adapted to having, because we both carry our last name Almond still, there's the sense that our family has always been a little bit open to the public. So in some ways I think it is empowering for her to have her side of the story and the truth of their love for each other kind of out there. She let me use a lot of the letters that he'd written to her when they were first getting together, and I think it really was a way to kind of tell her side of the story through me and through my curiosity, and also kind of humanize him, because he's really just seen through the lens of his music so strongly, that the whole idea that he had a family and had kind of a more tender side has never really come out. So I think that she was proud of me for trying to tell that whole story.
Well, I love the way you wrote the book, and I love the little time slips. And my favorite scene, I think, is when you're talking about your father and your Uncle Greg when they were little boys, and
yeah.
Their babysitter had neglected to change their diapers, so your grandmother had taught them how to change their own diapers, and you're telling it in the time in which it transpires, and then suddenly Greg Almond sits up on the couch and says to his mother, "What are you telling her about our tinkle pants? What stories are you telling her?"
That's right. Yeah, it was important to me to sort of show that, this really was a journey for me. This was really a quest, and I wanted the reader to sort of have their way into the story through me, because a lot of these stories I had never heard. But I also wanted it to read, almost the way good fiction does, where you could really see the scenes and get a sense of the people as full, kind of developed people. So it was important to me to sort of touch down every once in a while in the process of having conversations with people in the present. But I didn't want to sort of overburden the book with too much of that, because there was so much ground to cover and so many interesting things that happened within the lifetime of my father that I wanted to get really close to. But yeah, there were these funny moments of asking people to tell stories, and there's a lot of humor and levity as much as there's a lot of tragedy too. I think that there's a very specific kind of Southern way of telling stories, and I try to capture those voices,
Well, I've read Greg Almond's book also, and it's a very different take on the story than your book, and there's a certain kind of guy that likes women a lot.
Yeah.
But also wants to pretty much spend all their time with men, unless they're having sex with women or something like that.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a man's world, this rock and roll world, especially, in the late 60s and early 70s. It was fairly segregated, and I was always really aware of that when I was working on this story. I was raised... In some ways, the woman my mother became, the woman who raised me, was very influenced by feminism and was, doing it by herself. So she really was, subscribing to Ms. Magazine when I was a kid and reading The Second Sex, and had sort of an awakening through all of that, which I really benefited from, because, when I would go back and hear stories and realize how, the men really were kind of out in the world in a way that, their partners were staying home with the kids, and that was the arrangement. And in some ways, we really benefited from that arrangement. We had sort of a great idealistic little Southern home together, and a sort of communal home, which I think the kids really benefited from. But we also didn't have a clear picture of what it would have been like to have men around, you know. So it was definitely a strange gender story that I wanted to grapple with a little.
So did you grow up with a father figure?
I didn't. I really didn't. And the interesting thing is that kind of sense of having a larger group of women with children kind of persisted even after we left Georgia. You know, we maintained contact with a lot of the women who had been married to different members of the band or had been sisters and friends of the Almonds. And so there was always a sense of having a group of people that were living close by, if not together. You know, I lived in the same house as Brittany Oakley and Linda Oakley, who were the wife and child of the bass player for years until I was, you know, about 10 years old. So we really did have this kind of world of women and children that was really separate.
What about your relationship with Uncle Gregory?
You know, we get closer all the time. I was just at this festival in Live Oak, Florida, called the Wanee Festival that the Allman Brothers put on every year, and we had the best time there. You know, in some ways, it makes it even more bittersweet that my father's gone, because in some ways, as the men have aged, they've really opened up to their families and slowed down and come off the road. You know, they're not out there so much, and there is more family time, and they reach out for their kids more, and we've all kind of seen that happen, and it's beautiful. You know, there's been this kind of adjustment to a more kind of settled life, and so we have a great time together. He's a really funny, sweet, warm person. You know, and actually would surprise a lot of people, and I tried to capture a little bit of his personality, because he's quite shy and kind of, normal, grounded person in a lot of ways.
Did you have an ongoing relationship with him all these years?
I did. I saw him every year, you know, one way or another, but it was usually in concert settings. You know, and occasionally it would be maybe at my grandmother's house briefly, but, you know, there was very little time spent, you know, in his own home or when he settled, because he really did stay on the road quite a bit. And then, you know, maybe when I was in my early 30s, maybe for the last 15 years, I've made much more of an effort to sort of go where he is and spend time in his home and do that. But
You never went over to Aunt Cher's house or anything?
No, I don't think I ever saw a house where they lived. I was still pretty young. I mean, that was like 1975, so I think I was maybe 6. And I did meet her at shows, and I did know her and saw my cousin when he was a baby and have memories of her. And again, have memories of her as this really kind, warm woman who was just, you know, knitted into that whole group of people. So,
did you maintain a relationship with your cousin?
Did she? Oh,
Do you? No.
Oh, do I? Elijah and I have... Yeah, I actually saw him in New York in March. But, you know, all of us are sort of living our own separate adult lives, and the music still kind of brings us together, which is just a great gift.
That's cool.
And the occasional Thanksgiving or Christmas, you know, which my uncle does host with, like, you know, a dozen of us, so that's always fun.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's good.
We're talking with Galadriel Allman, and her book is called Please Be With Me, A Song for My Father, Dwayne Allman. What of the many things that you learned in your journey? You were like a private detective doing this research about your famous father. What did you learn that was most surprising?
There were a couple things that were surprising to me. I think one of the things was how much he sort of struggled before he found guitar. I didn't sort of see him as, you know, my grandmother had this really alarming quote when she said to me that he would have become a killer if he hadn't found a guitar. And she really did, he and his teenage friends at the time really did build this story of kind of menace. Like he was an angry young man. He was restless and frustrated a lot of the time, and I think a lot of that was about losing his dad and kind of coming to awareness of that as you do when you're an adolescent. And the guitar really became this channel, and it sort of clarified to me where that kind of fire came from and why he grabbed on so hard, is because he really needed it. He needed it emotionally as a tool of expression, and it really helped him. I think he became a lighter-hearted person once he had that conduit, you know. And I had never really seen him that way. He always seemed like a very sort of happy-go-lucky guy to me. If intense and, you know, powerful, he always seemed sort of just in his wheelhouse, you know. So it was interesting for me to think of him as sort of needing it and finding it. And then the other thing was just really learning about how brief the time was. I mean, I think the older I get and the more I look back on how brief his career was, it just astounded me to see how compressed the time frame was. You know, the fact that within 6 months of even meeting and being in a room, the Allman Brothers recorded their first demos. And those demos were so close to what the first album sounded like and to songs that they still play in much the same ways, you know. So they really did kind of come out of the box just on fire. And it's just astounding. It just seems like magic to me.
All in just a couple of years.
Yeah.
And all you've done in the last couple of years is just write one book.
I know. I'm resting on my laurels, obviously.
What do you think it is about the Allman Brothers band and about Duane Allman that they liked songs to be really long? I mean, some of their songs are really long.
Right.
One of them takes two albums up, right? It fades out at the end of
yeah,
one album and fades into the next.
Right. There are versions of Mountain Jam that are 45 minutes long. I mean, and I think that was part of the goal, was to write songs that they could almost explore the space within them. You know, which I think is a sort of carryover from things like jazz or even big bands, you know, this kind of swing, this idea of each man kind of stretching out and finding a sort of journey within the music. And you know, they really didn't have limits on them. And in some ways, it created this constant, spontaneous reinvention of the music that they still do, actually. You know, they still do jam on these songs in different ways than they ever have. You know, so it's kind of new all the time, and that's the goal, is to kind of be a performer more than just sort of replaying music that they already had figured out. You know, there's like a certain parameter that the song sets, but within that you can just go, you know, and they had such trust and such experience with each other that they could really support that, which, you know, it's very unusual. It's very rare, at least in this genre.
Did it surprise you that the Allman Brothers Band continued? I mean, obviously it didn't surprise you because you already knew, but I mean, as you went back and read the story, that they continued. I mean, the Beatles wouldn't have continued if John Lennon had died, or, you know, the Dave Clark Five certainly wouldn't have continued if Dave Clark hadn't been there. So that the Allman Brothers Band continued without Duane Allman, without even so much as a vacation.
You know, that was something that when I was younger, and especially maybe when I was a teenager, that was something that kind of hurt my feelings and I thought was kind of unfortunate and it didn't seem quite fair, you know. And even talking to my uncle, he would say, you know, that Duane got cheated. He didn't get to have his kind of moment of glory because they were really just about to break big, you know, and start to travel the world and start to have real success in playing stadiums and having gold albums. All of that happened just after my father died. So there is this sense of, like, he didn't get his due in a lot of ways. But at the same time, through telling this story and through talking to them, I really got the sense that how much they needed the music to heal. Because, you know, in many cases, this was the first time that death had come this close to any of these young people. And to say that it was traumatic is just a radical understatement. It was like having a limb removed from a body. You know, it was really this kind of deep and frightening loss to lose Duane and then to lose Barry a year later. I mean, it was really just kind of this shock, and I think that the music and carrying on what they knew these men loved to do and were absolutely committed and were about to succeed doing, you know, carrying on that vision became their way forward. And I honestly don't think any of them could have survived without it. I think they would have succumbed to drugs in a deeper way. They would have really struggled to find, you know, any kind of meaning in life without the music. So in some ways, as an older person, I think I understand it much better, and I'm grateful for it. I mean, the other piece of it is that I get to see the band play live, which could easily not have happened, and that's been a huge gift to me,
yeah.
You know, to be able to hear that those songs continually interpreted by really powerful musicians.
Yeah, yeah, that's fantastic. One of the other sort of sad stories in your book, which is I don't want people to think it's a morose, sad story, because it's not, but the chapter with Eric Clapton that resulted in Clapton's great work, Derek and the Dominoes, did not have such a happy ending.
No, it didn't, unfortunately. You know, that was one of the big, you know, I almost call pursuing that whole story my graduate degree, because I inherited my father's estate when I turned 18, and the thing that was happening at that moment is that the royalty payments for Layla had stopped, and I had to go quickly into the project of trying to find out why. And that was a whole, you know, a whole lengthy story that I don't get into in the book, but there was this sense of real sadness that this beautiful piece of work between two just remarkable musicians that had so much respect for each other, that respect didn't translate into equitable payment, let's say. You know, so it was really hard to get the information of why the money had stopped and to get any kind of settlement worked out, because by the time, you know, it finally was needing a legal resolution, you know, Eric Clapton is one of the most powerful men in music and very well regarded, and, you know, he sort of didn't have to face that. So that was the sort of sad coming of age reality check for me, is that the music business, it's kind of only what you can prove you deserve, you know.
It doesn't have a lot of heart, I guess.
No.
Well, so when you were researching the book, did you approach Eric Clapton? Did you talk to Eric Clapton?
I never got through to talking to him. I asked several times and wrote and tried to call through various people that I know in common with him, and it never happened, which was really unfortunate. And I guess part of me still holds out hope that someday it could, you know.
Well, you would think that he would. How busy is Eric Clapton that he can't spend a few minutes talking to his colleague's daughters?
And no, that's not to say that I haven't spoken to him in my life. I've met him several times, and he's always immensely kind. And I think, you know, they're two separate issues, basically, is what I try to express in the book, is there's the music and then there's the business. And in a lot of cases, they're at cross purposes. You know, and in a lot of cases, the musicians themselves, especially once they become really powerful, they don't have to deal with the business aspect, and they pass it along to other people. And I think, unfortunately, that may have been the barrier to talking to him, is the idea that the music wouldn't be the only discussion. It would be about money as well, which, you know,
it's part of the story.
Yeah. It is. Yeah.
Well, now that you've written this book, that, you know, this is the book of your, you know, of your life, but now you're a writer. So what will you do next?
Oh, that's the big question right at this very moment, actually. I have a few ideas. It's certainly, you know, such a huge new opening up of a world to me to be able to think about doing this as a living. You know, it's wonderful, and it's kind of the gift that keeps on giving that I get to pursue this path. But, you know, I hope to continue to write about music. I really loved writing, you know, nonfiction in a creative way, and I think that's sort of where my heart will stay. I'm interested in talking about children, you know, of musicians as well. I've met many of them along the way. And so I could easily see writing about that again. But, you know, the other temptation is to write fiction, because I wouldn't have to, you know, have dinner at night with the characters in my book. I could actually move on to something more whimsical and less fraught, I guess.
Well, whatever you do, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again. The book is called Please Be With Me, A Song from My Father, Duane Allman, and the author, my guest, Galadriel Allman. Thanks for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Galadriel Allman. Her book is called Please Be With Me, A Song from My Father, Duane Allman. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night.